Hello, this is Jill Pasternak. Welcome to Crossover, the program that explores the universal language, music.
Good evening, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome to another in our series of library concerts, intimate recitals for your early evening listening pleasure. In our studios this evening is Mr. David Grünschlag, violinist. Tonight marks his first appearance in this country. Mr. Grünschlag, since 1936, has been the concertmaster of the Israeli Philharmonic Symphony Orchestra in Israel. Accompanying David Grünschlag at the piano will be his sister, Toni. Our guest violinist opens his program with the Sonata da Camera by Pietro Locatelli, an 18th century composer whose music falls into two distinct types. He wrote many etudes and caprices, evidently written merely for practice, which have little or no musical value. On the other hand, his sonatas and concerti, his serious music, show a tremendous amount of talent. We hear now Locatelli's Sonata da Camera performed by our guest, David Grünschlag.
We just heard violinist David Grünschlag performing the first movement of Pietro Locatelli's Sonata da Camera. You've just heard an historic recording from 1949 from the New York City radio station WNYC, featuring the first performance in the United States by the great violinist David Grünschlag. David Grünschlag was the concertmaster of the Israel Philharmonic Orchestra, and his story is really quite compelling. His daughter, Dorit Strauss, will be discussing that at the Gershman Y on November 14th. But we are paying tribute today on Crossover to a great, great violinist and a great movement that took place in 1936. And we will be speaking with his daughter, Dorit Strauss, here today. We had already done a show on this wonderful documentary, Orchestra of Exiles, Josh Aronson was responsible for. And it is very funny how things happen, but you obviously had something to do with that as well. But you have a rather strange little tale about how all of this came about.
The whole thing started with my meeting Joshua Bell in the subway in New York.
I think that he wasn't playing, was he? Because I know.
No, wait a minute.
He had played for a while.
Yes.
He did some, you know, subway stuff like that.
He did that in Washington, but
yeah.
This was before he did the Washington thing. This was in 2005, and I just bumped into, I was taking the subway on a business appointment. He was on the subway just going somewhere, and I saw him from the corner of my eye, and I kind of knew that I knew him from somewhere, but I really didn't expect someone of his stature, you know,
to be taking the subway, right?
Yeah, and then he got up to give me a seat.
He's a great guy.
Yeah, so I was a little annoyed, thinking, what, am I that old? I need a seat, you know? And then I said, no, sit down. You have a double violin case. I don't want your violins to get jostled. So he looked at me.
And that started the conversation.
Yeah, he says, how do you know I have a double violin case? I said, well, my dad was a violinist. I know he had one. So he said, who was your dad?
Oh, my.
So I said to him, oh, you never heard of him. You haven't heard of him because he died 10 years ago, but he was the concertmaster of the Israel Philharmonic. So he whispers to me, I have here the Huberman Strad. I said, oh, I know who you are.
Oh, my goodness. Oh, my goodness.
So that's how we had a little friendship. And then I got him he agreed to play a concert in Vienna to commemorate Huberman. And then on the way, you know, in the summer before we were going to Vienna, I said to Josh, why don't you come with Aronson? I said, why don't you come with me to Vienna? And you can film this concert. You can make a movie out of it. So he looks at me and he says, Dorit, that's an event. I'll get you a camera guy in Vienna, and we'll do an event there, you know, and you'll just film it, and you'll have it. I said, no. It's not about the concert with Joshua Bell. It's about Bronislaw Huberman. And then I told him the whole story about Huberman was, blah, blah. He said, that's a movie. So that's how the whole thing started.
It's very exciting.
Absolutely.
Because that's the way it started, and that, of course, is the way that that things happen. But this whole idea, I was so, not only me, but I don't think people are at all aware of what was going on in those years when they got the Jews out of Germany,
right.
And Poland as well.
Right.
And of course, the passports that they had to get. Wasn't Ben-Gurion involved in helping as well?
Well, Ben-Gurion was the head of the Jewish Agency, and getting certificate to get into Palestine required two bodies, the Jewish Agency and the British Home Office, because they had to approve that. And they gave a certain number of certificates that to allocate for immigration to Palestine, because, you know, they didn't have an open immigration policy because of the political situations with the Arabs, who did not want Jewish immigration to Palestine.
Right.
So it was sort of a between the two of them. And Ben-Gurion was sort of felt that many of the musicians who would come wouldn't stay and would leave. So he was trying to use as many of the certificates for people who would come as pioneers, work the land, and be committed Zionists. And he didn't feel that these musicians were committed Zionists. So there was a bit of a, and this is something that Josh found in his research for the film, because I was not aware of this struggle. And through his research, he found that out. And that was very important. I think in,
What year are we talking about?
We're talking about
39 or 40?
No, earlier. We're talking from in 19, from the time that Huberman started, from 1934, 35, when he started with the concept of the orchestra, there was already limited immigration to Palestine. So we're talking about the time when Huberman was trying to get his musicians to Palestine. You couldn't just bring them there. You had to get the approval of both those bodies. So he was having difficulties.
And for the audience that it does not know about the background of Israel,
yes.
Those were the years when they were partitioning Israel, and it was
not yet. No, the partition plan came when in the late 40s, before Israel was declared
a state. Okay.
So this is still under mandate controlled Palestine.
Okay.
Yes.
And of course, it was Britain, of course, the British had the power.
Absolutely.
So this was already, but this was also the beginning of the, not the Holocaust in the true sense, but the beginning of the horrible situation in Europe.
Oh, absolutely, because by 1933, when Hitler took power of Germany as a chancellor of Germany, very shortly thereafter started all the rulings against Jews, and he was already rounding people up and sending them to various detention camps.
Right.
For example, Sachsenhausen, which is right outside of Berlin, already had Jews housed there, and then he let them go, and then they came back again, and so forth. But my father, who was Huberman's protege, my father studied with Huberman. Actually, my father met Huberman, or played for him, when he was 13 years old, and Huberman took him on as his protege. And a few years later, when my dad was a little bit older, when he was 21, and that was already 1935, he was standing right next to Huberman during a recording session with the Vienna Philharmonic, with Isaiah Dobrovin conducting. And Huberman was telling Dobrovin, you don't know what they're doing to these people in Germany, to the Jews in Germany. They're sending them to concentration camps. Now, I heard this directly from my father, who I interviewed in 1994 about his early years in Vienna and Berlin.
And for the audience, your father's name was David Grunschlag, is that
David Grunschlag, yes.
Okay. And he was he concertmaster of the Philharmonic, the Israel Philharmonic?
Yes, he was concertmaster of the Israel Philharmonic. They had a rotational system with three concertmasters. But in the early years, not only was he, a member of the orchestra, but he was a frequent soloist with the orchestra, playing under the batons of many conductors. And I just found a letter that my dad wrote to his family in 1940, I think, who were not in Palestine, his parents and his sisters, saying that Huberman was coming to Palestine and he was playing the Bach double violin concerto with Huberman.
Oh my goodness.
Yes.
Although David Grünschlag is concertmaster of the Israel Symphony, he also finds time to appear as soloist with the orchestra. While still in Europe, Mr. Grünschlag studied in Vienna, having a scholarship to study with the late Huberman. When in Berlin, he studied with an equally famous teacher, Willy Hess. And now Mr. Grünschlag continues his program with Vidui, or Deep Sorrow, by Ernest Bloch.
Another historic recording performed by David Grünschlag, Deep Sorrow by Ernest Bloch. So then this all was prior to, Israel wasn't what it is now, of course, at the time.
Of course, yeah.
And of course, Europe was a mess and everyone was aware of what was going on, but not to the, I think, the extreme degree. That information, I think, was really not that available in the United States, say, in 1933. I mean, there was stuff going on. I know for a fact my father was from Poland, and mm-hmm. he had family that went to Auschwitz and mm-hmm. so on. But I remember hearing, of course, that this was all going on. And what I found so fascinating was that all of this was going on prior to the real admission of what was the situation in Europe. And this started a long time before.
Absolutely. And that is why I feel that Huberman is one of the great figures of history, because he saw what was going on and he immediately grasped the situation, that it was not going to end just in Germany, that Hitler was actually an Austrian, and that it was going to go on from other places. He understood the whole relevance of it. And I think one of the reasons that he understood that was that he was not just a violinist or a fabulous great musician. He had sort of international political aspirations himself. He was a student of the Pan-European movement and actually took a couple of years of his life to study in Paris and wrote a pamphlet about the Pan-European movement. So he was someone who saw the world in large terms.
Mm-hmm.
And as my father had said to me, he said Huberman was a friend of kings and queens. He traveled in the highest circles. So he heard from other, you know, major figures about their concerns about Hitler, and he understood it himself. And that's why he raised the alarms already in 1933, as soon as Hitler came into power, and continued raising the alarms. But the bells got louder and louder for
yes.
him, and he expedited his need to create this orchestra and bring the musicians to Palestine.
Now, I understand that Toscanini was involved on some level.
Yes. Huberman understood that he needed to bring a lot of attention to his new orchestra. So he chose as his conductor for the first concerts Arturo Toscanini, who was of like mind as far as fighting the fascists. He'd already made his stand known against Hitler, that he was not going to perform again at Beirut, for Wagner.
Toscanini was a patriot. I mean, I think that was something that was known.
And I mean, no, now, I think.
Yes.
And he was not, because of course Italy became fascist.
Yes.
Completely.
Well, he totally took an anti-fascist stand early on. And so Huberman understood that that would be a great PR, you know, victory
right.
for him to bring Toscanini to Palestine to conduct the first concerts. And when I interviewed my father, he talked about, you know, Toscanini coming. Of course, Toscanini came at the very end. It was Wilhelm Steinberg, or William Steinberg, who ended up in the Pittsburgh
yes,
Symphony,
right. mm-hmm.
who's the one who prepared the orchestra for Toscanini to come. And then when Toscanini came in, he put the finishing touches on the concert.
And when you say when he came into Israel?
To Palestine,
to
yes.
To Palestine. Of course,
yes.
It was Palestine, yes.
Yes, yes.
Right. So this was so. When actually was the orchestra formed? I mean, what was the year?
1936. The inaugural concert was in December 27th, I believe, of 1936, and there was this very gala big opening with 3,000 people coming to hear the concert, all these dignitaries, the British
yes.
mandate officers and so forth.
Mm-hmm.
And I think to put it in context, at the time, the Jewish, you know, population was very, very small, maybe, you know, probably less than 500,000 people. So the idea that 3,000 people would come to your first inaugural concert
That's amazing.
Is astounding.
Yes.
And in fact, when I interviewed my father, and I asked him, where did they play? And he told me they played in the convention center where there were room for 3,000 people. And I was just amazed. The idea of Tel Aviv at the time, which was a tiny little place just sprouting mm-hmm. out of the sand, that 3,000 people should come hear your concert. And it was a very, very, you know, incredible, you know, experience.
To hear more of this fascinating conversation with Dorit Strauss and author-journalist Carol Saline, and view the film Orchestra of Exiles at the Gershman Y on November 14th at 11 a.m., call for tickets 215-545-4400 or go to the web at pjff.org. Hear now a portion of the violin concerto by Israeli composer Paul Ben-Haim, performed by violinist Itzhak Perlman with the Israel Philharmonic Orchestra conducted by Zubin Mehta. Music of the contemporary Israeli composer Paul Ben-Haim. We heard the second and third movements of his violin concerto, the Andante Affettuoso and the Vivo, performed by violinist Itzhak Perlman with the Israel Philharmonic Orchestra Zubin Mehta conducting. I'm Jill Pasternak. You're listening to Crossover.
Thank you.
We've just heard the great blues singer Bessie Smith, a vintage recording of St. Louis Blues, music, of course, of W.C. Handy, and the subject of a wonderful show that is being presented by the People's Light and Theater Company. The Devil's Music, the Life and Blues of Bessie Smith, starring our guest today, Mickey Braden.
Welcome to Crossover, Missy.
Thank you.
It's really a pleasure. Tell us a little bit. Well, I have to say that we have an audience of a certain age, but I think we have a lot of people that don't even know who Bessie Smith was. Tell us a little bit about her.
Bessie Smith was the Empress of the Blues.
Oh,
she went far past Queen and everything. She's the one, to me, that put blues on the forefront as far as just putting it to a top level. She was an amazing singer, producer, arranger. She did a little bit of everything.
Can you categorize blues? I mean, can you? We know what it is. It's a kind of a, you're bemoaning your fate and your loves and your life and so on. But how did it originate?
Blues is not just a sad music. A lot of people say when they have the blues, they're sad, but it's it was a party music. It was a fun music. Categorizing it is, it's somewhere between the folk, the country blues folk, the spirituals, the gospels. It has all of it together.
So musically, it's really crossing into many different areas.
Yes, it does.
Yeah. I mean, can you improvise on the blues?
Oh, yes, you definitely can. One of the things, especially with the 12-bar blues, you know, the first two lines are the same, and then the last line is like the punchline. It's like telling a joke. And usually on the second line, when you're singing after you've done the first line, you little improv on that, and then you do the punch with that punchline, the last one.
Can you give us a little phrase without music, without accompaniment?
Have you ever loved a man who was no good? Have you ever loved a man who was no good? No matter what you did for him, he never understood.
Well, the sense of the words is perfect. It makes sense, and you're wonderful. Now,
Thank you.
You are, the show is about, is it about the blues, or is it about Bessie,
It's really about Bessie Smith and her life in the blues.
Where did she come from?
She was from Chattanooga. She was born in Chattanooga somewhere around 1894, 95. They're not exactly sure.
Yes, and was she musical? Did she study? I mean, what was the whole approach?
In the studying part, I'm sure she went to church, but it said that she used to dance in the streets. Her brother played the guitar, and she would sing and dance and get pennies to help support the family. And when she turned 18, she went and joined a traveling show, which Ma Rainey was the reigning diva of.
And you were in a show about Ma Rainey, weren't you?
Yes, I did Ma Rainey's Black Bottom.
And you've done quite a lot. You portrayed, was it... Billie Holiday at some point?
Lady Day at her Mrs.
Lady
Bar
Day.
And Grill.
Oh, yeah.
Yes.
Okay. Now, where were all these done? Can you tell us?
Well, Lady Day, I started in Detroit. And Danny Fruchter and James Pine came to Detroit from People's Light in 88. It was 88. And they came and said they wanted to bring us to People's Light. So that was my very first show out of town.
My goodness. Well, of course, Detroit is the home of the blues, I think.
And
or
jazz,
somebody,
and jazz. R&B and gospel.
Okay, and we'll get the calls later.
Yes, yeah, of course.
But it's just wonderful. Well, now, how long is the show going to be running?
We're running through November 24th. And if everybody is nice and fills up the house, we will extend to December 1st.
Tell us a little bit about People's Theater and Light and Theater. I mean, it's a professional house.
Yes, it is. I don't know exactly how it got started, but I was here 25 years ago, and it was just an amazing group. They did so many innovative things. The theaters at the time were all like black boxes. There's a larger one. I'm in the Steinbright, which is the smaller one. And they were able to configure the audience into different kinds of ways. Even the stage may have had different levels or something at that time. You know, but I know there's an amazing innovative theater.
Okay. Yes, I know they do things that that are other people don't do. And we're really delighted to have them on the circuit, as it were.
Have you ever loved a man who was no good? Have you ever loved a man who was no good? No matter what you did for him, he never understood.
We just heard Mickey Braden as Bessie Smith singing Bessie Smith's Dirty No Gooders Blues.
But as far as you're concerned, I mean, you have many, many hats that you wear. You of course, are a singer, a musician, an arranger, but you've also been a director of a record company. Is that right?
I'm the vice president of the company of Where My CD Is, which is Diva Out of Bounds, Ms. Mickey, which is on iTunes. And that's with PMP Records, Peggy Miller Productions. Peggy Miller is my partner in the other record company. And, you know, there's quite a few other things. I just love to do music.
So where is home? Is it still Detroit now?
No, it's Newark now.
Newark, New Jersey. Okay, it's famed Newark. And there's a lot of jazz going on there, isn't there? What I wanted to also find out about is your tours. You've gone to the Far East, to Japan, and I know jazz is very, very, very strong there.
African-American music in general is very big there. And I went with a friend, Masa Wada. She had a band called the Swing Masa Band. And I went for 11 years. And I love Japan.
Japan loves jazz. I was, believe it or not, in Guam for a while. And I remember we had some jazz pianists that were coming just from a stint in Japan. Evidently, it's very, very, very popular there.
I had a Japanese vocal student who went on to the Apollo. She couldn't speak English, but she sang Through the Fire by Chaka Khan and won twice.
Oh, my goodness.
They study the music. They really get into it and just love the music. And it feels good when you go there.
So now you're, of course, performing. You're directing. You've done, music as well. When you're through with this run, do you have any other plans that are,
Yes, well, we're going to do the show again in Boston area, Merrimack Theater in Lowell, Massachusetts.
Okay.
And then I'm going to Vegas to start working on a new work called The Tempest, the Shakespearean piece.
My.
But they're doing it to the music of Tom Waits.
Oh,
and
my.
Teller of Penn & Teller is doing some, I think he's a co-writer and co-director
sure.
with Aaron Posner from Red Bank Theater. And I'm looking forward to this experience. I've never worked in Vegas. I've been there. But then it's an ART production from Harvard. So
that's okay. Upper crust, I guess.
No, yes.
Really, but I was reading in the notes about you, and there's so much to ask you about. You were in the International Women's Jazz Festival in Japan. Now, why a women's jazz festival?
The young lady, Masa, who was my sponsor over there, whose band I was in, I think she was a part of creating this women's jazz festival, and she would help bring people from the States because she lives in both places. And it was a great experience, if I remember. I think we were there about 10 days, and the music that came from all over the world was just some amazing things. Jazz is so universal.
Well, music is universal,
yes.
I think. And of course, especially when you go to Asia, though, you don't realize it because the whole concept there of the tonality and so on is really different. But I think they've embraced Western music.
Oh,
very,
yes,
very
they
much.
Have.
Yeah. I also read something about you contributing to a newsletter, a Human Rights Coalition newsletter.
Yes, in Tondobayashi in Osaka, I wrote a five-part article on Harriet Tubman.
There was
a group of people there called the Buraku who were discriminated against, just like black people in the United States. And we would exchange different ideas and stuff. So they wanted to know some more about the history. So I wrote a piece on Harriet Tubman and the whole, you know, escaping, the whole freedom.
Yes, of course.
Underground Railroad.
Yeah, the Underground Railroad. Mm-hmm. And of course, here you are in Philadelphia, the home of. So tell us again, what's the schedule here is now you're going to be doing this show until when? And then you're going to be touring with it.
Yeah, November 24th is right now the last, but December 1st, if we extend, then I go into Merrimack in January and then into Vegas in February.
Now, incidentally, in your spare time, I read that you are a minister of music for the Unity Fellowship Church of New Brunswick, New Jersey.
Now it's in Newark. We all combined.
You moved.
In Newark.
Okay.
Yeah, we call it Newark instead of Newark.
Yeah. No, we used to call it NERC. Oh, I'm from the old days of Newark, and I never really tell anybody about that because when I left to go to New York, and I left, I was only 16.
Okay.
But I remember Newark. It was quite a marvelous city.
Yes, yeah, Sarah Vaughan came out of there.
Yes.
So many greats.
Oh, yes. And we had also the Mosque Theater. I remember we would have the great, great artists that would be on their way to Carnegie Hall, and they would play at the Mosque Theater right near Military Park were talking about.
Yes.
And then, of course, WBGO, I think, is there
still there.
It's a wonderful jazz station. And then it went through changes, but I think Newark is, again, emerging.
Oh, it is truly emerging. They're building so much there.
They have probably one of the greatest museums in the world in Newark.
Museum.
Yes, the Newark Museum. And, of course, the Performing Arts Center is way down in the Ironbound section near that. So, but, of course, to me, it's really exciting to just see the changes and everything. So what's on your plate immediately now, besides entertaining the audience and getting rave reviews?
Well, I brought my dogs with me, and I like making things for them. So that's my other pastime. I'm looking forward to doing a few CDs. One is going to be in tribute to my mother, who passed away in May. Okay. And she was a musician, amazing classic and spirituals. You know, she was an amazing musician. She played for Paul Robeson when he used to come
my.
To Detroit.
Oh, my.
And I wanted to do something in tribute to her with some of her arrangements, as well as doing some of my own music.
Well, now you told me briefly that you had studied classical music as well.
When I first started, yes, Bach is my favorite. I listen to the Swingle Singers.
Oh, they're marvelous.
In the dressing room.
They're marvelous.
I'm a Bach fanatic, and them swinging on the Bach is just amazing.
Do a little
and
counterpoint.
It helps to warm my voice up.
Wonderful,
you know,
wonderful.
So I can't do anything too strong because I have to use so much power on the stage.
Well, I wish we could hear you sing a lot more. And as long as this is running, I just wish you the very, very best. Keep us posted on whatever other plans that you are, you know, making and your recordings as well.
Thank you.
Now, the recordings you said are on iTunes.
Yeah, Diva Out of Bounds, Ms. Mickey. Also, I'm on James Carter's CDs, Gardenias for Lady Day, and At the Crossroads. I'm at those two CDs of his.
Yes. Okay. Now, how about Broadway? Are you doing anything there?
I would love to. Your mouth to God's ears.
Okay. Well, I did
off Broadway.
Well, anyone who's listening who's in the theater,
some money, something.
Well, Broadway is also trying to survive in a way. They have some great things going on, but I think we're very lucky to have people's light here, and I am so happy to welcome you to this part of the world.
Thank you.
And hope to hear your recordings and also to see the show.
Thank you so much.
Thanks for visiting. We've been speaking with Mickey Braden, starring in The Devil's Music, The Life and Blues of Bessie Smith, presented by People's Light and Theater. The show runs through November 24th. For tickets, 610-644-3500 or peopleslight.org. I'm Jill Pasternak. Until next time.
For a second listen to selected Crossover interviews, visit WRTI.org. Crossover was produced by Jill Pasternak in the studios of WRTI Philadelphia for the WRTI Radio Network. This is Joe Patti, Crossover's technical producer. Crossover is syndicated nationally by Global Media Group Incorporated. Thanks for listening.